world. And his parents were survivors, Chassidish Yidden. And he grew up in Cleveland. He went to a Chassidish Cheder. He's no youngster, 70 or slightly more. And very, very wonderful people. And he has, I understand, a fine business which his son is coming to. Of course, everyone needs an electrician occasionally. All right, let us roll. It's the world to do. Where is Jack? I need Jack. I'm responding. I'm thwarted. Yesterday I responded to the twinkle in Yitz Rubin's eyes, and he wasn't here. That's for you.
Thank you. Is this thing on?
Nothing's on. What do you want? You want it on? It's cold?
Yeah,
whatever you want. Turn it on.
Are you...
Turn it on.
Turn it on. Turn it on.
We're dressed for our Ben Moshe Shir. He turns it off. It can be in the middle of the winter. It can be snowing outside. There's no, so we come dressed in sweaters.
Whatever. It's good. It's 23.
I always say he's the one who's working. When I used to teach summer school, they would come to me and say, you know what's going on? Summer school in Washington.
Yeah, it was plenty hot.
They were sitting in winter coats because I was working.
Air conditioning.
I put the air conditioning on.
And they were wearing winter coats. I wore winter coats in Mechola in the early 70s. That's how there was no heating. It was a different Israel then. But our Baruch Hashem. All right, today is Monday, the 17th of February, 2020. And we're ready to roll. A big hello to my students in front of me and to the many listening around the world. Just to mention, with the next week is normal. The week afterwards is Election Day, no class. For many reasons, but
Monday.
Yeah.
Sunday they're all people.
Yeah, Sunday's normal, but Monday we have the problem of Election Day and people doing things and voting and all that goes with it. And since the class is essentially outsiders, not insiders, we'll call it off. The week afterwards is Tainit Esther, so I want to begin at 9:15. There's regular classes then, but I'll make it a 5-10 minutes later, so Vic can say Shlichus B'Menuchat HaNefesh, not have the time pressure on him. Now, coming back to Rabbi Rachman and all that he engendered, and it's a problem that lives on until today. I can tell you, I have correspondence I have to respond to, and it's a topic that, as Jack keeps on saying, yeah, but you see, there is Hafkat Kedushin in the Gemara. Yes, there is Hafkat Kedushin, but there's a big difference. If you have a concept of a person getting married and he didn't tell his wife that he was insane, he was institutionalized, so it's as if there was no marriage. If 20 years later he goes insane, yes, 20 years later he is insane, no question about it, but that marriage 20 years earlier took place. Jack, are you with me? There's a big, big difference. Now, I'm being very popular. If I wanted to go into real nitty-gritty details, I could take off another 2 years, but I did it and I published, so I have what to do this morning. But there is another factor, and this Jack is correct. Jack asked around in the Shtiblach, Talmidei Chachamim, and there is Hafkat Kedushin, and they all said the Rabbanim are afraid to do anything because of the breakdown in sexual standards today. Now, there is some truth to this, but still we're limited. In other words, Mekach Ta'ut, you have Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, and I'm even willing to accept that the man was a criminal and was incarcerated and his wife didn't know. I know I had a case many years ago, and I learned there was another story like this. A student of mine, a very fine young lady, but very naive. She came from a semi-Haredi background, and she's going out with this guy, and he tells her he's in medical school, and he's MD, and they get engaged, they get married. It turns out, lo dubim velo ya. When he would say he's in school, he wandered around on the streets. A very tragic story. He gave a get. But there you could make a case if he didn't want to give a get and he was holding them up for money, You could make a case, mekach taot. And I heard of another case like that too. I can tell you, subsequently she married very nicely into a very fine Hasidish family, and they've lived happily ever after, and both she and her husband, whenever I'm in America and they're within striking distance, they come to hear me give a shir, and they give me, ach, yashikoyach, yashikoyach. And I have a lot of nachat seeing how she went further. But you have to differentiate. On the other hand, it is real, the breakdown in moral standards. If you open up the Gemara in Sota and see what the Gemara has to say, Haba Leishadish, and every day when I daven in a certain shul, I see a certain individual who's, don't want to say another word, Talmud Chacham, what he did and that. In the meantime, Ba Leishadish, she had to get divorced because she was an Eshadish, and his wife stayed with him. How happy the marriage remained after that, I don't know. But we're living in a world where it's beyond comprehension. The breakdown. The court just recognized here two fathers and one mother. They share the same woman and the two fathers. The court, you have judges here who never opened up a chumash, never learned a pasuk Rashi in chumash, and they're judges. God have mercy where we're living. And as I told you yesterday with Putin, the article in the Yediot, so it was fascinating. On one hand, he has a pilegish. They say it's only one pilegish. At least you got to give him credit. He doesn't equal the presidents, some of the presidents of the United States. On one hand, he has a pilegish. And on the other hand, this very pilegish led the battle in the Politburo against same-sex marriages. So, what's going on here? What level? How do we judge it? Sheva mitzvah. But we'll leave it for others to decide. Okay. Charlie, to answer your question, I have something I'll give you afterwards. And you asked me about Rabbi Krauss's based and what Rabbi Willig's feelings are. You'll see from what I'm giving you that it's probably absolutely negative. You'll see Rav Heschel Shechter, and I don't think Mori Willig differs with him at all. And their attitude is that the Beit Din, these are not Gedolei Yisrael. In order to deal with this material, you need Gedolei Yisrael. All right, could be. Again, as I've said, I'd love to see something in writing, but the little bit I hear from afar, I have the feeling that the Beit Din is inclined towards Rabbi Rachman, and that immediately creates problems. Now, I want to thank my Talmud, Nachum Shrager Zajac. He sent me some fascinating articles on Rabbi Rachman. One article was published evidently in a festschrift for Rabbi Rachman. It's by Charlie Liebman. It's a memoir, some personal recollections. And the other article appeared in Modern Judaism, May 2008, by David Singer. Yeah, David Singer. I was about to say Israel Singer, but someone else. It's by David Singer. Now, I read both articles, and I can tell you my presentation of Rabbi Rachman is right on. What I did gain from the articles is, number one, a confirmation. Remember the tshuvot? I ended off last week's class with the tshuvot of Reb Moshe. Those tshuvot were written against Rabbi Rachman. So what I said to you, it is said, these articles confirmed it. That's number one. Number two, with Rabbi Rachman's title, again, I'm coming up with the contradiction. What was his title in Yeshiva University? While no one has really researched it and published a scholarly work, my conclusion is that until 1970, he was called assistant to the president. 1970, they gave him the title provost. And that's why Rabbi Rachman felt he had a very good chance of inheriting Rabbi Belkin, even though he's a year older than Rabbi Belkin. Rabbi Rachman was born in 1910. Rabbi Belkin was born in 1911, but health-wise, Rabbi Belkin's health was deeply, grievously affected by the burden of Yeshiva University, And Rabbi Rachman lived L'Aricha Jamim Tovin to 98. So even though he was a year older, he was a viable candidate. But ultimately, with Reb Chaim Soloveitchik and Rabbi Soloveitchik, Mori Rebbe, and the swing to the right, as they say, he realized he had no chance to be president, and that's the shift to Bar Ilan, everything I told you. What's fascinating about Charlie, by the way, David Singer's article is quite right-wing, meaning he really puts Rabbi Rachman in the right-wing conservative camp. I told you my own feeling was when I first read One Man's Judaism, I felt he's walking a fine line between left-wing orthodoxy and right-wing conservatism. The Singer article really is quite sharp in tone. Charlie Liebman, who I knew so well, who became famous off my Tzaris, Plain and Simple, Charlie's article is quite interesting. And he raises one question. Why did the Torah world come down so hard on Rabbi Rachman? After all, by the 1970s, you had Duvi Hartman, you had Yitz Greenberg, and yet the one person they were furious with, and Reb Moshe writes to Chivot against him, and the Rav attacks him in public, and Duvi Hartman and Yitz Greenberg are afterthoughts. It's left for Rakefet to show that they're not within the consensus of the Torah world. And he gives her an answer. I would have given it myself. He's absolutely right. I'll tell you what the difference is. So-called modern orthodoxy. No one represented it better than Emanuel Rachman. He grew up within Yeshiva University. He was a Talmud of Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. His father was a good friend of Rabbi Revel. His father taught at Yeshiva for 2 years when he came to America and afterwards went to Albany, opened a store, and made a living not from the rabbinate. Rachman himself, PhD, professor, teaches at Yeshiva University. Sharei Tfila. At the time, maybe some of you remember, at the time, Sharei Tfila was one of the most prominent Orthodox congregations. What did you have at the time? Kehilat Jeshurun, Jewish Center, the Breuers up Washington Heights, that was an island unto itself. And who never heard of Sharei Tfila? I told you, Sunday morning we all wanted to hear what Rabbi Rachman said in Sharei Tfila and what Rabbi Polkowitz said in the White Shul. That was everyone want. These were the two great preachers, speakers. Rabbi Rachman, Rabbinical Council of America, vice president, president. You had no greater representative of modern orthodoxy from within the YU, RCA, OU world. And this man, One Man's Judaism, the Hafkat Kedushin, the proposal, the tremendous controversy with Moreinu v'Rabbeinu, Rav Soloveitchik, the illegitimate Dayston in Kew Gardens Hills. Wow. On the other hand, you take Yitz Greenberg. Who is Yitz Greenberg? All right, he graduated BTA. Then he never set foot in yeshiva again. Where'd he get a smicha? Nevadik. He wasn't flesh and blood of the YU scene. You take Duvi Hartman, everyone knew he's the guy who came from Lakewood. He's the guy that inspired a kid named Donnie Rothkopf to go to Lakewood to seek out Reb Aaron Cutler. I mean, this is the truth. I have to tell you the truth. I was desperate to go to Lakewood, stay in Lakewood, all because of Duvi Hartman. He was an outsider. And both of them, were in different professions. Yitz Greenberg was a professor at the city universities. Duvi Hartman winds up in Montreal, winds up getting a doctorate there. What does that have to do with YU, RCA, OU? Neither of them were persona grata like Emanuel Rachman, who was the blood and flesh of what was called already modern orthodoxy. So it's a good point that Charlie Liebman makes, Zichrono Livracha, that when all is said and done, Rabbi Rachman was one of the family. And when one of the family goes astray, you get angry. But when a fremda, how do you say that in English, an alien, a foreigner, someone who's not part of the, he's an outsider, he's a gekumene, he came, all right, he joined the little, all right, you don't get hysterical. And I'll accept that halach lemaisa. But these were two fascinating articles, and Baruch Hashem, I'm right on. All right, now, let's go a drop further.
Are you going to give that out?
You can have them. Yeah. I don't need them. Yitz, I dealt with you yesterday. The look in your eye, your question, the answer. Did you hear yesterday's shiur yet? I already got emails on yesterday's shiur. You start in it, and you weren't here. But I read the look in your eye 1 week ago. You'll hear it in the shiur. It's okay. Let's drill further. The articles mentioned that the person that constantly beat up on Rabbi Rachman was, as you heard from Yitz Rubin weeks ago, Rabbi David Hollander. Now, what's fascinating is their lifespan was practically parallel. Rabbi Rachman was born 1910. He died in 2008. Rabbi Hollander was born 1913. He died in 2009. So their lifespans literally, they lived at the same time. It was really, they didn't just overlap, but they were total contemporaries. Now, Rabbi David Hollander, first of all, I knew him very well. He was the most important rabbi in the Bronx when I was growing up. He was born in Hungary. He was 9 years old when he immigrated with his family to New York. His native language was Yiddish. The man was unparalleled as a speaker. It was very interesting. The Bronx had a number of rabbis who were fantastic speakers in Yiddish and in English. One of them is Rav Heschel Schechter. You all know his son, Yaakov Yosef, J.J. Schechter, YU. Rabbi David Hollander was the other one. He graduated the yeshiva. We'll interview him in a minute. And he was elected rabbi of Mount Eden Jewish Center in the Bronx, 1943. Remained its rabbi until the synagogue disbanded in 1980. At the time, the Balabatim wanted to sell the synagogue to a church. They would have gotten a fortune of money. They owed Rabbi Hollander back salary for many, many months. He waived all the money they owed him. They shouldn't sell it to a church. Later, the synagogue was knocked down and it was reconstructed, buildings, private apartments, family housing, etc. And you got to give the man a lot of credit. At that point, he was ready to retire, and he went to see the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He was no youngster already, 1980, born in 1913, and the Rebbe told him off and said to him, "You're retiring? I'm older than you." Rebbe was born 1902, and I'm still taking on new responsibilities, and you're ready to retire. And that's how he wound up in Brighton Beach. And ultimately, I'll give you all the details in a minute, and ultimately in Brighton Beach, the Russians, he goes on to become the eldest full-time practicing rabbi in the United States. What happened in Brighton Beach? Two congregations merged. One was an old-time shul, and one was an organization that was organized to reach out to the Russians who overwhelmed the United States. Malka's parents, after they got married, lived in Brighton Beach. And a few years ago, a number of years ago, could be 10 years ago already, we decided to go back and visit them. Malka had a letter with their address on it. And we go back, Brighton Beach, and we find the building, and a lady walks out, and she immediately speaks to us in Russian. You follow? Took for granted we're Russians. And that whole area, you could hear Russian all over. That's the ones who came, their children already are Americanized, and politicians, a lot is being done to reach out to them, but he became the rabbi. And fascinating individual, continued until the day he died, the full-time rabbinate. Now, let me talk a little bit about the Bronx. You all hear the Bronx. I often tell people that this building is a Bronx mafia. Yours truly from the Bronx, Rabbi David Miller from the Bronx, Rabbi Avishai David from the Bronx. You see, what happened was the Jews constantly are moving on. As I mentioned the other day, I hear in class in a different context, Mea Shearim is worth more. If you want to buy an apartment in Mea Shearim, you're going to pay 10 times the price index that you would have paid 100 years ago. It's the only, by the way, in Tel Aviv, you see what happens, South Tel Aviv, you don't find a Jew anymore. God have mercy, what's happening? The children in school, it's all foreigners. You know what I'm talking about. The foreigners who invaded Tel Aviv and the leftists, the furious that were trying to send them back to Uganda. There's a change of neighborhood. But everywhere else in Israel, the old is rebuilt. It's still Jaffa. Oh, half the army bases are still in Jaffa. And people live near the sea, new shuls. I know people who moved there, not just your children, Jack, but it's a different world here. But in America and in London and elsewhere, and in Paris, wherever you go, they'll show you the old Jewish quarter. The old Jewish quarter was the East Side. From the East Side, those that made it big moved up to the Upper East Side or to the Upper West Side. Those who didn't make it that big moved to Harlem. And Harlem, like my parents, my grandparents lived originally on the upper, on the Lower East Side. My parents already were born in Harlem. Ah, when Harlem started going black and the Jews made a little bit more money, the third area of settlement that attracted hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Jews was the Bronx. Now, in the Bronx, again, you begin with the South Bronx. The South Bronx was closer to Harlem. But then they made a little bit more money. They came to the Mount Eden area. That was the area around Yankee Stadium and further north. The courthouse was there. The Plaza Hotel was there. Ah, the concourse, the Grand Concourse. The shuls on the Grand Concourse, Young Israel, the Grand Concourse, shuls a block away, shtibbles a block off the concourse, Concourse Center of Israel, further north. Ah, this area, and the heart of the area, there was no bigger, more prosperous, more successful shul than Mount Eden Center. And that was Rabbi David Hollander. And I can tell you, one Shabbat, the Rav davened in Mount Eden Center, Shabbos morning. Why did the Rav daven there? His wife's sister was married to Professor Lisman, who taught math at Yeshiva College. Remember the name? And Frum people, descendants today, wonderful people. And the Lisman boy was celebrating his bar mitzvah. So it was the Rav's nephew. And I can tell you that Shabbos morning, the place was so crowded. Ellie, if you came late, standing room only. Every kid walked from every area of the Bronx. The Rav is here for Shabbos. And Rabbi Hollander, Rebbe, please speak. No, the Rav refused to speak. He told Rabbi, no, it's a regular Shabbos. You do what you have to do. And you can imagine Rabbi Hollander speaking. But something happened that morning that was very fascinating. There was another bar mitzvah boy. Now you have two bar mitzvah boys the same Shabbos. Vic, who reads the Haftorah? Who gets maftir? What do you do? Do you understand this? And what are you going to do? Say to the Lisman kid, you're getting it because you have this big yichus? What are you doing with the other kid? You're slapping his face. You're telling him you're a nobody. You don't have, what? The other kid? We want him to be a gadol be Yisrael. It's a bar mitzvah. What do you do? No, the Rav came up with a solution. As long as I live, I can never forget that Shabbos morning. We reach maftir, and Rav says, points to me, this one, go out, I will call you back in when I need you. Mm-hmm. And he kicks out 10 of us, 10 of us. And this kid, the other kid, reads the Haftorah, fine. Call them back in. We all march back in. And the Rav says, no, you have achiyuv now to hear maftir and to hear the Haftorah. And the Lisman boy reads the Haftorah, reads the maftir and the Haftorah. And I'll never forget one of the Bala, you know, Bala Batma, not everyone is that learned. I mean, in the shtibble, I can assure you, the people that told Jack that they don't want to introduce some with Putin and Trump running the world with all their sexual standards and the prince of the British Empire, Ribbono Shel Olam, a good friend of Epstein, and with Harvey Weinstein around, what a world we have. Unbelievable. So not every balabas is that learned. He gives an answer, fine. So I remember there was Rabbi Savitz there. Rabbi Savitz ran Yeshiva Salanta. He was of Boston origins. His father was a sheikh in Boston. A real interesting individual, Rabbi Savitz. And I remember one of the Balabatim sends to Rabbi Savitz, says, Rabbi, what are they doing? I never saw this in my life. What are they, crazy? 10 boys out, 10 boys in, repeating. Rabbi Savitz says, Macha Shvai du Amoritz, Shteita de Godel Hador, and Ed Gehesin, Efir de Meluchador, Macha Shvai an Amoritz Abur. Oh my God, Ellie, do I have to translate for you? You got the feeling. Oh, I'll never forget that. So this, now, the other part of the day is more fascinating. Where did the Rav daven mincha? Shalashuda, Shabbos? Two blocks away from Concourse, from Mount Eaton Center, was yeshiva that Rabbi Gerelich established, the famous Rabbi Ruchim Gerelich. And there was a shul, Rabbi Ruchim Gerelich, Gevenda Balabas, and the Rav is in the Bronx, Daven with Ruchim Gerelich. Ah, there Rabbi Ruchim says, Rabbi, the Olam Velhern for my Hashtikel Teda, they want to hear a little Torah. There the Rav spoke. I still remember in Yiddish, Ahava, the year and the difference between them. And I, years later, I said to myself, I understand, Rebbe. In Mount Eden Center was a modern Orthodox congregation, Balabatim, Ahin and Aher. Oh boy, my Yiddish is good and it's going to kill me because I'm forgetting my English. How do you say Ahin and Aher? It's impossible to translate. Ahin and Aher, they were this type and that type. What are you saying?
Chicken in the
rabbit. This type, that type, Hashem is Shabbos, Halb Hashem is Shabbos. But the Rav was the modern Orthodox preacher. He spoke, you take Mori, you take Yishayim, you take his Yiddish. Ah, Rabbi Ruchim Gerelich, Ba'emin Shtivel, all the survivors were there, all the refugees, 90% of the people, their native language till they were 21 was Yiddish. There the Rav had an olam. And there, wow, he wowed the audience. They were sitting there and wow, the Rav.
You were there, right?
I was there, of course I was there. The Rav, what a schut.
Tell us what he said.
That ahava, that yira, you have to deal with the masses. But the more you learn, the more you appreciate ahavat Hashem. And you want a proof to it? I can take a guy named Rakefet. He chokes over Yosef Mizrahi. Why? Because are you listening to the Yosef Mizrahi? Kulo Yirat Hashem. I don't know. I'm listening to track the Torah Hashem because of so much fear. The love of God, the love of Torah, the love of the Jewish people, that's a much higher level. And that's the way the Rav spoke that time, and Kedako B'Kodesh, the Rambam in Hilchat Deyot, Hilchat Talmud Torah, he built a whole little fascinating building within 25 minutes. All right, now, who is Rabbi Hollander? Rabbi Hollander, you cannot judge from published writings. He wrote every week in the Morgen Journal in Yiddish. He wrote in Jewish press in English. Yes, yes.
I lived outside of Philadelphia. I would travel purposely to Philadelphia to find the Torah Morgen Journal. He had the column on the pasta in English.
In English. Because he wrote...
It was wonderful.
No. He was a fabulous preacher, fabulous speaker, but there was no, I'll use the word, no one could take on the reforming conservative with more strength and more decisiveness than David Hollander.
And
more what word are you using?
Nastiness.
I'm going to interview him in a minute. You're going to see he's not so nasty.
They knife you in the back in the most genteel manner.
Right, but here it's vulgarity. He was not. It's not Rabbi Rachman who published the. You know, remember Rabbi Rachman's doctorate? I didn't mention he had a doctorate. The Emerging Israeli Constitution. He did the doctorate at Columbia, and in its time, it was very classic, very important. He showed the Constitution of Israel and how it emerges and how you have references to general law and yet there's the Jewish tradition in it. It was a masterpiece. He had that, One Man's Judaism. Rabbi Rachman produced quite a bit of scholarship. David Hollander, you cannot say, was a great scholar. He was a Talmud Chacham and he was a preacher par excellence. Now, an interview appeared with him December 16th, 2003. This interview appeared in the Jewish Week. And the interviewer, Steve Lippman, who still writes for the Jewish Week, describes at 90 years of age, David Hollander is still festy after all these years. There's a Bear Minion this Friday morning at the Hebrew Alliance of Brighton, by the sea. It's referring, of course, to the Atlantic Ocean. It's an old minion with a Russian accent. 10 men, most pensioners from the former Soviet Union, all of them with white talasim draped over their heads, sit at tables in the basement study hall of the synagogue in the height of Brighton Beach, Brooklyn's gateway for emigres. Siddurim in hand, they quietly read their Hebrew prayers. At the end of Shacharit, one of the worshippers helps the Shalich Tzibor, who stood at the front of the room leading prayers, remove his talis. The prayer leader is the oldest man in the Hebrew Alliance this morning, Rabbi David Hollander, who just turned 90. And it goes on, the eldest rabbi in America, full-time rabbinate. He still teaches, delivers Shabbat sermons, answers congregants' questions, and writes his pair of weekly columns for the Jewish press and the Yiddish language forward. I am serving as a rabbi, like any other pulpit rabbi, he says. His health is good for a man his age. His reading glasses are tucked away. His hearing is a little weak. I walk with difficulty, he says, but no complaints. I know the score, Rabbi Hollander says. God has blessed me with years, but only he knows how many. The rabbi shows a visitor a letter he recently sent to this newspaper, the Jewish Week. It's an attack on Orthodox recognition of non-Orthodox denominations. And they quote Rabbi Hollander, his letter, the very word denomination is a heretical concept, he says, for it implies that there can be a legitimate Judaism outside the laws of the written and oral Torahs given by God at Sinai. Without prompting, he starts describing his lifelong, often lonely crusade against the leaders. I don't blame the laity of conservative Reform Judaism. It is their leaders. He talks about declarations issued and speeches given about conservative and Reform leaders with whom he debated on radio talk shows. Now, I have to tell you, what he's touching upon here is exactly what a guy named Rakefet touched upon in this very class, touches it upon time and again, and touched upon making Charlie Hexter a shliach. Now, what are we talking about? Finally, we have a lady who is in charge of Judaism. She's the one, and the government, the minister, Chotobeli, to reach out to the Jews all over the world. And the leftists here go crazy. You're wearing a shetel. You're Orthodox. And she says, yes, I'm an Orthodox Jew, but I will reach out to everyone. My own belief and commitment doesn't affect my broadness. And Rakefet made Charlie a shliach to tell her, don't say you're an Orthodox Jew. Say you are an observant Jew. There's only one way to be observant. And you want to be Jewish? The more observant you are, the better the Jew. What is observant? Shabbat, Kashrut, Tarat Mishpacha, Torah Hashem Tamima. What the heck is Rakefet saying? When you say you're an Orthodox Jew, you imply pluralism. I'm Orthodox, you're conservative, you're Reform, and this is the issue that haunts us. Synagogue Council, and we'll come to it in more detail later on, had no greater opponent than Rabbi David Hollander. He ranted, he raged against Synagogue Council, mixed board of rabbis, because what's the message you're given? Orthodox synagogue, conservative temple, Reform temple, we're all equal. Pay your nickel and take your choice. And this was Rabbi Hollander. And he was way right of center on this issue, just as Rabbi Rachman was left of center on this issue. And he took up the cudgels against non-orthodoxy 6 decades ago when he became spiritual leader of Mount Eden Center in the Bronx Grand Concourse area and has never put them down. And now they quote Rabbi Hollander, I represent the right wing, he says. I took a very strong stand. I carried on the fight for the last 60 years. I am, he says, not a moderate in any way. And you see, Yitz Rubin is shaking, but Rabbi Hollander speaks clearly. He talks about his background, part of which would seem at odds with his Fabrenta persona. He learned at Yeshiva University's rabbinical school. He received the ordination from Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. He speaks only in glowing terms about the Rav. Quote, Rabbi Soloveitchik was my teacher, my friend. End quote. A poster with Rabbi Soloveitchik's photo is posted near the shul's front door. So you see, on one hand, you have Rabbi David Hollander. And I can still remember when the ISA was issued in 1956, which I've lectured on time and again from every different vantage point, because in my humble opinion, if you want to talk about the history of Torah in the United States, there are many years that are important. 1886, fine. Found what new? Vic, what's so important? The founding of Eitz Chaim, which ultimately becomes Yeshiva University. We're sitting here in Eitz Chaim Yeshiva. Don't forget it. 1941, Rabbi Aaron Cutler arrives in America. The sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe arrives in America. Those are, I think he came 1940. Those are important years. No question about it. The seventh Rebbe came in 71, if I'm not mistaken. 1941. Oh, what did I say? 71? Sorry. Jumped ahead 30 years. 1956, that's the Issur signed by the 11 Rashi Yeshiva. And Rabbi Hollander was a strong proponent. Rabbi Rackman was on the other end. But I'll tell you what's interesting about Rabbi Hollander. Here you have a man who you would say, well, his right wing represents the rightest element in Yeshiva University, the Rabbinical Council of America. On the other hand, there was no greater Zionist than Rabbi Hollander. Total supporter of the Mizrahi movement. You'll see in a few minutes how interesting this factor is when you reveal his personal life. Rabbi Hollander, you know, not so simple. Today in Yeshiva University, you have the faculty. Now what's going on? Shortly there's going to be elections for the World Zionist Congress. Any Jew who pays the shekel, a certain small sum of membership, and doesn't live in Israel, is not an Israeli citizen, is entitled to vote. They're pleading with people, come out and vote. A lot of money is at stake. The future of the type of image that the Jewish agency will cast is at stake. Will it be Shabbat and Kashrut and Parat Mishpacha, or will it be homosexuality and lesbians and lesbianism and Chilul Shabbos and buses on Shabbos and all that goes with the liberal world? And they're pleading with rabbis to come out and say, vote for the religious slate. It's all combined. There's no machlokes here, because Aguda doesn't take part, unfortunately. Aguda doesn't take part. Eda Haredit doesn't take part. Satma doesn't take part. Zionism. And among the Rosh Yeshiva from YU, Rav Heschel Schechter and others sign on. Vote for the religious slate. And their Rosh Yeshiva in YU who refused to sign on. They will have nothing to do with Zionism. Official Zionism. Theodor Herzl. What? We can be part of this? Rosh Yeshiva. Eli may have studied with some of them. Ribbono Shel Olam, you got to understand what we're talking about. And you'll see in a few minutes, it's even more than what I'm saying. But this is Rabbi David Hollander. They interviewed a Reform rabbi with a very interesting name, Rabbi Slotowicz. Recognize the name? Who knows if he isn't related to the founder of Art Scroll. And Rabbi Slotowicz says he gave a lecture several years ago at Congregation Rodef Shalom in Manhattan. During the question and answer period, Rabbi Hollander had a question. Quote the Reform rabbi, he would not address me as rabbi, Rabbi Slotowicz says. He would say, Dr. Slotowicz. Rabbi Slotowicz does not remember the subject of the question, but he remembers the tone. He was always respectful. He was civil. He was not rude at all. But he was an Orthodox rabbi who refused to recognize Reforming conservative. They interviewed Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld. Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld says about Rabbi Hollander, quote, he's a very principled person. He has almost an obsession with reform and conservative. And you see, this is Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld speaking. No one will suspect that he is a Kaldat, that he is in favor of synagogue council, but Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld, much more nuanced, much closer in that respect to the Rav. Rabbi Hollander, Wow. He represented the right wing. Rabbi Hollander came to the United States in Hungary with his family at 9, says he did not intend to make the rabbinate his career. I wanted to be a lawyer. He's, by the way, had a law degree. It seemed like the proper thing to do. He finished Brooklyn Law School while going to YU, but during the Depression, offices from synagogues were more plentiful and better paying than legal clerkships. During, I guess it's the fallout of the Depression, he was studying, yeah, the Depression years, absolutely. You had to have a rabbi, but a lawyer was a luxury. His sermons during rabbinical internships attracted several congregations. God gave me a certain gift. I was able to speak, he says. Now, what happened that the Bronx went under? And here you have to be a Bronxite to understand. In the 1960s, they started developing areas much more north than Mount Eden Center. And ultimately it was Co-op City. Anyone ever see Co-op City? It was like a communist, if you ever were to communist Russia, they built buildings on top of buildings on top of buildings looking exactly the same. You could have 5 square blocks with enough apartments for hundreds of thousands of people. Co-op City, very similar. A whole area of building on top of building on top of building. I see it before my eyes. Rental was cheap. The buildings were considered a better neighborhood than the Mount Nittany area, which is starting to change. And within 10 years, there was nothing left in Mount Eden. Everyone moved to Co-op City, or at least everyone who didn't have the money to move to Queens, move back to the Upper West Side, ultimately the Five Towns, New Jersey, Englewood, afterwards Teaneck. Everyone moved to Co-op City, and you wound up in the Bronx where there barely was a minion. And that was the end of these large, beautiful, magnificent shuls. Concourse Center of Israel, does any of you remember what that building was? Right, they didn't have machitza. Had separate seating, but no machitza. Men and women next to each other, no machitza. The rabbi for many years was a leading graduate of the seminary, Rabbi Drab. And then he was succeeded by a graduate of the yeshiva, by Rabbi Morris Berman. And it was considered an Orthodox shul. I taught there my final year getting smicha. I ran the youth minyan on Shabbos. I davened in the Beis Medrash, the first minyan there. There was a machitza. The youth minyan afterwards took the Beis Medrash, so we had a machitza. And I have the schut that there's a girl in East Brunswick who became from that year that I taught there. I told you, when I came to East Brunswick, she showed me the siddur I gave her, inscribed to her, and my stamp album that I gave her, a gift. Amazing what you see a grandmother today from children, grandchildren, kanayin hara. But an event happened that we're going to come back to. An event that shakes the greater Jewish world until today. Under Stalin, the persecution of the Jews increased tenfold. It's not just that he persecuted Jews, I don't have to tell you. Tens of millions of Russian citizens, Jews and non-Jews, ultimately were executed or died in exile. When Stalin died, Khrushchev took over, and there was the thaw, there was the famous, I'm sure you've studied this, the famous Khrushchev speech that they tried to hide, where he spoke about the terrible deeds of Stalin and we can't go on like this. A copy of the speech was smuggled out to the Western world, and there was a bit of a thaw. Part of that thaw the rabbis jumped on it, and in the mid-50s, they arranged a rabbinic visit to the Soviet Union. The first group that went was a group of Rabbinical Council of American Orthodox rabbis. Rabbi Hollander was one of that group. And anyone who visited the Soviet Union during this period and saw the Jews and what went on and their struggle, and Yitzchak and I are included in this, you were never the same again. Rabbi Hollander was never the same again. He, perhaps more than anyone else, was so successful in Russia. There were five rabbis. We're going to come in detail. Rabbi Rakin was one of them. It's not yet for now, when we deal with RCA, when we come back to RCA. And Rabbi Rakin, one talk he gave at the great synagogue, the Choral Synagogue, the only functioning, I'm using a KGB word now, Ellie, the only functioning synagogue in Moscow, the Choral Synagogue on Akhapova Street. Et achai ani mevakesh. That was his drasha. Do you understand? Take it literally and take it figuratively. Et achai ani mevakesh. His drasha was in Yiddish. They say there wasn't a dry eye in the synagogue. And Rabbi Hollander was not the same. And that's why when the Lubavitcher Rebbe told them off, so you had this group in Brighton Beach, there wasn't money. These are immigrants. These are impoverished people. But some of them yet knew Yiddishkeit from the old country. Some of them yet knew Yiddishkeit before 1917. Some of them wanted to seek out Yiddishkeit in the great United States, where religion is considered positive, not negative. And Rabbi Rakin was a perfect fit. And ultimately what happened was the Brighton Beach Jewish Center, which basically, it was now 80% Russians. In addition, there was an organization that Chabad had organized of outreach to Russians. And it was a perfect shidduch. They combined together, and Rabbi Hollander was a perfect rabbi. He lacked the Russian language, but most of these people was still native in Yiddish. And as I've told you many times, my ability to speak Yiddish, to teach in Yiddish, was one of the greatest gifts I had, because in the 1980s, outside of Moscow and Leningrad, you came to Riga, you came to Minsk, you came to Vilna. The Jews did not speak Hebrew. Moscow, Leningrad, you had a different element. You had the Serufnikim, you had classes, Yuli Edelstein and others learning, studying Hebrew. You could speak Hebrew. There was always someone who could translate. You had very intelligent people. When I spoke before the scientists in refusal, so I spoke in English, and there was always someone who could translate English to Russian if they didn't understand something, Hebrew to Russian. The smaller cities, there wasn't a Jew above the age of 40 whose native language was not Yiddish. So it came to be a great blessing that in seventh grade, I had Rebbeim who didn't speak a word of English, and you had kids like me who didn't speak a word of Yiddish. And this is Rabbi Hollander. This is why Brighton Beach worked out so beautifully. Yes, yes, Morty. Normal. Oh, what was it? Yeah. Oh, of course. Look at pictures of him. Tall, distinguished. What's interesting is he had a younger brother. Did you know Fred Hollander, Yitz? His younger brother was exactly the opposite. Total opposite. Aze Edel, quiet, still, politically so astute, could handle right, left, center. He always laughed. He said, yeah, he says, I'm like my older brother, but I'm not like my older brother. I actually taught his daughter in Mishlala. When I came in Aliyah, at that moment in time, I was one of the first, if not the first, I hate to say it, when I left America, a guy is crazy, going Aliyah, what will be with him? I told you, Dr. Belkin made a farewell dinner for me and gave me covered malachim, and he ended off his talk, and Dr. Rotkoff, we want you to know, whenever you will come back, there will always be opposition for you at Yeshiva University. But by the mid-70s, there were more rabbis coming, the Six-Day War, the Yom Kippur War, the impact, retiring, coming, and RCA started a presence here. And Rabbi Fred Hollander was hired to become the director. He was the first one, what you have today, the OU Center, the first part, the first blossoming was this little RCA rabbinate headed up by Fred Hollander. Now, this was David Hollander. Now, David Hollander had no children. So it's hard to speak. It's not like Rabbi Rachman, where I know all his three sons, and all of them are Yerayim, Vishleimim, and fine Jews. But to David Hollander, it's hard to speak. He had no children, which is sad. But now I want to come to the most interesting part of today's shiur, and you'll see why. Not many people know this or can appreciate it. Well, we spoke about it in class. Was it yesterday or last? Forget already how important the wife is. I quoted Rabbi Prezansky yesterday. Ellie, can you quote it back to me? If your wife is happy, you are happy. If your wife is not happy, you are not happy. And it's very important, the lady we marry, because this determines our whole gestalt and life situation. Rabbi David Hollander and Rabbi Moshe Scherer were married to sisters. No, Vic, did you know that? Now you can appreciate what I said 10 minutes ago, 15 minutes ago, that Rabbi David Hollander was a confirmed Zionist. I quote him, I'm not just a supporter of Eretz Yisrael, but I am a big supporter of Medinat Yisrael. And Dov, you know, a lot of people who are not Zionist are Gudistim, even the Rav. I got a letter from the Rav, Yerushalayim, Eretz Yisrael. Right or wrong? And you'll see people, Eretz Yisrael, we have nothing against it. No, my Medina, no, that's not. David Hollander boasted, I'm a supporter of Medina Yisrael, not just Eretz Yisrael. Now, who is his father-in-law? Who was his wife? And you see, this is very fascinating. Let me move sideways and let me talk about David Hollander's father-in-law, Rabbi Fortman of the White Shoe. He is the individual.
What's his name?
Fortman, F-O-R-T. M-A-N, Rabbi Shimshon Zelig Fortman. He was known as Rabbi Zelig Fortman. And I'm quoting, where do I get the information? So let me recommend a certain volume to you. Rabbi Scherer. You're familiar with it? By Jonathan Rosenblum, published by Art Scroll. Now I got to tell you in advance, the volume is very nice. There's only one problem with the volume. It's what we spoke about yesterday. It totally leaves out who Rabbi Scherer's brothers were. Rabbi Scherer came from a family of three brothers. His mother and Michael Tress's mother. You've heard of the famous Michael Tress? There's an Art Scroll book about him. What's it? They called him Mike, I think. What's it called? Yeah, but they called him Mike. They called the Mike, I think the book is called, Elimelech Tress. So they were first cousins, and their mothers were sisters. Rabbi Scherer, you follow me, Dov?
Yeah.
This is living history. I knew these people. And the sisters were very frum. In America, remained very frum. And out of Rabbi Scherer's family, he's the only one who remained frum. Not just that remained frum. One brother davened in a conservative temple, was a businessman, and nothing to do with real Yiddishkeit, but at least was conservative, whatever that means. The other brother, Harry Scherer, knew Yitzchak. Did you ever meet Harry Scherer? He died, they had Aricha German Tov, and he died not like Moshe. He died close to 100. Not only a Reform rabbi, but did marriage ceremonies for Jew and Gentile. Atkedekach. And I don't want to go into more details. The man could have destroyed me, but I saw his sinning when I was an impressionable kid with hormones, 11, 12 years old, 12 years old, 12, 13. Principle of Salat. Don't you, Yitzchak, you have studied Washington? What's the story I tell there? Harry Scherer says to me, I had this appointment with him, and I had my daughter with me, my eldest daughter. She had just graduated Mechlan. I took her to New York to stay with her grandparents. And she comes with me, and Harry Scherer says to me, Rabbi Rakefet, we have investigated who you are, if you wanted this appointment with me, and we conclude that you're a Gaon and a Tzaddik and the last Mizrachiite in the world. And I said, Rabbi Scherer, I don't know whether I'm a Gaon and a Tzaddik, but in your office, you're correct. I'm the last Mizrachiite in the world. By the way, I knew your brother Harry very well. He was my principal. And boy, the atmosphere changed. And when we came out, I'll never forget it, Lower Manhattan, Beekman Avenue, and Taina says to me, my daughter says to me, Abba, here he put you down, and you say something about his brother, and suddenly he's so friendly and cautious in what he's saying to you. I said, Tanya, you didn't understand. He was telling me he's from, I'm not from. I said, well, I know who your brother was. I don't want to go into more detail, gentlemen. My mouth doesn't want to say certain things. Wow! This was the Scherer family. So I read the biography and I was, God, how do you leave that out? You got to talk about who his brothers were.
What was his first name?
Harry. Give Harry Scherer. He was a graduate of Torah Vadas. And then he went on to get Reform ordination.
No, but who? The Rabbi Scherer that you were interviewed.
Moshe Scherer, Morris Scherer, who are we talking about? The man who put a good Israel on the map in the United States, Canada, single-handedly. The most important person with political influence. Am I right or wrong, though? The OU student, everyone. We became tremendous friends when the family put out a volume in his memory. My letters to him are right there in the volume. They're not ashamed of it. So I checked with his son. I said, Shimshon, his only son. Well, I think he had two daughters, one son. I said, show what your father had to overcome. It's not simple. Give him credit. Who are we talking about? What background? When, where? Born in Brooklyn. He said to me, Rabbarin, you're absolutely right. But my mother said to me, you can do whatever you want to immortalize your father. I'm willing to give you tens of thousands. But if there's one word about his brother Harry, count me out. So this is Rabbi Scherer. This is where he comes from. Torah Vadas boy, he winds up in Ne Yisrael. Charlie, I know your family near Israel. They're in Baltimore, right or wrong. But tell me, why does a kid leave Torah Vadas and run away to Baltimore? He's a Brooklyn kid. The rumor has it they wanted to get him away from his older brother's influence. You follow? Harry? Oh no, get him away. Get him to Baltimore. And it was a very smart move. Now, Rabbi Zelig Fortman, who was he? Rabbi Moshe Scherer marries before David Hollander. David Hollander married late in his early 30s. 1943, he marries Debbie Fortman, the daughter of Rabbi Zelig Fortman, the rabbi of Congregation Knesset Israel, known as the White Shul of Far Rockaway. How'd he meet her? The Kallah was working at the time as a secretary in the Tzire Agudat Israel office. According to a long-standing family joke, she did not meet Rabbi Scherer's exacting standards as a secretary, but he was too kind-hearted to fire her. The only alternative was to marry her and take advantage of the youth council's anti-nepotism policy. You follow? New Dove, you know anything about the OU? You worked for them. Yeah. New anti-nepotism. Who works for the OU? Shoshana Shachter, Rebbetzin Shachter. When they hired her, suddenly someone said, how can you hire Rabbi Shachter also? He's the posek for the OU, anti-nepotism. So they approached Rabbi Heschler and said, all right, I'll resign. You follow? Suddenly that policy disappeared. But very fascinating story. This is the family that he later marries into, the sister of Deborah. Mrs. Scherer often joked that he had married her, Mary Fung, to Rabbi Scherer, because he was so enamored of her father, Rabbi Fortman. Rabbi Fortman came from the Litvische shtetl Starobin. Do you recognize the name? Who was Rabbi Starobin when he was growing up? Reb David Feinstein, the father of Reb Moshe. Reb Moshe and Rabbi Fortman, as kids, learned together, played together, engaged in mischief together. They grew up in the same little shtetl. Rabbi Fortman later learns in Slutz, under Rabbi Sazamu Meltzer. This is Eitz Chaim Yeshiva. This is the forerunner Slutz, the Kletz to Lakewood. Who was his chavruta? No, who did we talk about yesterday in my office? Rav Shach, exactly. Rav Ezra Menachem Man Shach, he was the chavruta. But this Rabbi Fortman was a little different. Comes to America, terrific speaker, Talmud Chacham, native language Yiddish, but in America, he recognizes he must master English. He has to be able to speak in English. The younger generation is more at home in English. He used to pay a Mr. Rabinowitz, the Baal Korei, in a nearby shul to help him learn English. Much of the time, he would read the New York Times aloud, and Mr. Rabinowitz would correct him. Rabbi Fortman attached so much importance to learning to speak English well that he paid Mr. Rabinowitz the princely sum in those days of $5 an hour. All right? You get a feeling already what we're talking about. Rabbi Fortman, Rabbi Scherer, and this is the family Rabbi Hollander comes into. Rabbi Fortman, by the way, I'm quoting here, if anyone gets hold of the volume, you want to see it, I'm quoting here beginning on page 118. It's about five different pages, but what we're going to say now, you're not going to forget this. It captures the rabbin at the ear of the person. Tell me, what is Rabbi Riskin's biggest problem all his decades in the rabbinate? No, Shlomo Riskin, which aliyah does he get when they call him up to the Torah?
Kohen,
exactly. How can you be a rabbi and not be able to participate in funerals? And here's a good vart. Rabbi Fortman was a Kohen. He struggled at first with his livelihood. He couldn't conduct funerals. He couldn't conduct hakamat matseva. In the words of one local wit, he was out shtena Undena, Steiner meaning stones, monuments. He couldn't come at Matseva. Bena, a dead body is just bones. He as nicht mit Steiner and nicht mit Bena. But listen to this story. I've heard this story many times over, but here it's attributed to Rabbi Fortman. One time there's this big funeral in Far Rockaway, and it's a hush of a person who died. All the Rabbanim are there, and Rabbi Fortman is standing outside the shul. Another rabbi is going inside. He sees Rabbi Fortman. He says, Reb Zelig, if you could eulogize this person, what would you say? And Rabbi Fortman gives him a whole little eulogy. Guy goes in, and he's one of the speakers. He speaks. Then everyone is coming out, and the family sees Rabbi Fortman, and they say, Fortman, zug, a bissel vetter, say something. You're standing outside. And he says exactly what the guy said inside. Instead of saying, Rabbi Fortman hat mir gesagt, er wird gewollt sagen, he would have said, etc., etc. He's poor Rabbi Fortman, you follow? Oh boy, did he learn a lesson from that. And they end off with this little tale in Rabbi Fortman quoting the Gemara in Shabbos 119b. It's the Gemara that says that if the Jews would observe two Shabbatot, Mashiach would be here. You're familiar with the Gemara. Rakevet has spoken many times. I don't understand this Gemara. Either one Shabbos or three Shabbos. What does two Shabbos mean? I have my own book, but it's not important now. What's important is Rabbi Fassman would always speak about this. If the Jews would observe two Shabbatot, it means the Rabbanim who speak on Shabbos Tshuva, Shabbos HaGadol, if they would observe it properly and be honest. And when they give Divrei Torah, to tell who they are robbing it from. If they would observe these two Shabbatot, and this is the Rav's part, so then Mashiach would be here, they'd be honest. The Rav's part, I'm breaking into Yiddish, I'm living it, I heard from the Rav in the mid-50s, the Rav said, there's no Chiddush in Drush today. Everyone is copying someone else. But he says there's Geneva to Yom and Geneva to Laila. Yaakov Avinu would love him. He says, what's the difference? Geneva to Yom is when you acknowledge who you got it from. Geneva to Laila is when you say it over and you don't acknowledge it all. And this is the family. This is Rabbi Hollander. He married Faye. Faye was a sister of Deborah, of Debbie. Both Rabbi Moshe Scherer and Rabbi David Hollander were zeichim to arichat yamim tovim with their wives. Rabbi Scherer, unfortunately, should have lived longer. He died, I think he was in his 60s. It was such a capable, wonderful individual. Rabbi Scherer suffered too. Don't think you can get away with being an agudist. When he came to Israel, the Knesiyah Gedolah in 1980, the newspapers, by then Rabbi Scherer was world famous, Mr. America, Mr. Torah Jew with connections. When Rakefet wants to reach the President of the United States, the senators, he goes to Rabbi Scherer, and he did have all these connections. And boy, the Haredi press went crazy here. A gate via galach, you know in Yiddish, a galach, it means you shave, it's upgegalach, he's clean shaven. It's a play on words, a galach is a priest, the priest is also clean shaven. Ayve, what they gave him here in the press, that he's clean shaven, that he shaves, he had to apologize, had to explain. The Gedolim in America want him to be shaven. That way he goes to the White House. He doesn't raise any people and don't have any blockage. They see clean shaven. He's one of us. He's modern. They listen. If he'd have a beard, etc., he wouldn't have that same impact. But that's Rabbi Scherer. That's Rabbi Hollander. Rabbi Hollander, nemesis par excellence of Rabbi Rachman. Yes.
In what way, besides the biological relationship, did Rabbi Scherer and Rabbi Hollander interconnect?
On their opposition to reform and conservative, they were exactly the same. on their attitude to Medinat Yisrael, Rabbi Hollander related to Medinat Yisrael, sang Hatikva, head of the Mizrahi, outspoken. Rabbi Shera related to Eretz Yisrael. Chas v'chalila would never sing Hatikva written by Naftali Hertz, Ember, that Eisvaf, that Mekubal, that sick soul, etc., etc. Rabbi Hollander related to Memshelet Yisrael, Mizrahi, the problems, the understanding, the compromises that were made. Rabbi Shera, Agudat Yisrael, Hitzalti et Nafshi, V'shalom al Yisrael, Chinech Atzmai, totally, totally different. This is why you got to give Rabbi David Hollander all the credit in the world. Married to the sister of Rabbi Shera's wife, look how close the relationship is, Rabbi Fortman's daughters, and one, a great Mizrahiite, and one, single-handedly, built Aguda in the United States. Fascinating, fascinating people, achievement. And Harry Shera, don't forget Harry Shera. Morty, when I wrote Washington, I corresponded with him. I have letters in his late 90s. He wrote exactly the way he wrote when he was a kid, dealing with Santa Yeshiva principal. Oh my gosh, unbelievable. You know what's amazing? When he died, his money, what was left after illness, etc., he willed a great part of his estate, new, can anyone tell me, to Lubavitch, which shows you in his old age who cared about him, who took care of him, Lubavitch. If you want to know about Harry Shera, after we turn the microphone off, I'll tell you this true story. All right, last week I was honest, I gave you the true story, I'll turn the microphone off, and Jack, etc. Okay. Let me go a step further. I can't do much further, but we're reliving it. There's another person on the RCA scene who, more than anyone else, is Mr. Rabbinical Council of America. The Rabbinical Council was very smart, and they saw in advance what would happen to Bibi Netanyahu. Bibi Netanyahu, I once had a discussion with Joseph Borg. Adob, I apologize, but in my life I was privileged to talk with many great people. I was a kid, I sought it out here in Israel. Yosef Borg, Eli doesn't even know who he is today, but go to Aravagon Google, Joseph B-U-R-G, I think in English, Borg. So I asked him, why is it in Israel that the politicians ultimately kill each other? And he said, because they don't know when to resign in dignity. In other words, you can't be a politician forever. People, the Israeli system, you turn 70, a doctor can't operate. My brother can't operate anymore for 10 years already. You turn 60, what age did they kick you out of Weizmann's? What's it, 67? 66, 67. Hebrew U, Weizmann, Technion, the army. There was no more dedicated soldier than my son-in-law, Danny Ackerman, and he twice won the highest prize in the Army Development. He's a Machon Lev graduate, development on Merkava 2. They're now up my grandson is now working on Merkava 5. You follow where we're at? But that was Merkava 2. I think Merkava 3, he also played a role. At the end of 20 years, you're out. That's it. The army that retires you in dignity. I finished at 48. They want to kick me out. Remember, I protested. Took me another 5 years. I turned 53. Nothing helped. That's it. Make a little party in your honor. They gave me a medal from the Shlom HaGalil and saluted me. I'll never forget it. And that's it. I never heard from the army again. Every week I'd get a notice. I'm here, I'm there, and everywhere. Never heard that this is the way Israel works. So I hinted something now and then. Yo, Eber Kahat Seichel, you got to retire in dignity. I'm lucky I'm a Rebbe as long as I have to teach. What to teach? I have students and Imodela Kaddish Baruch Hu. It's a different ballpark. But RCA saw if you have a president, he can't serve more than 2 terms. I think it's 2 terms. It's 4 years total. That's it. They want to keep dignity and give younger people a chance. It's just like the Israeli army or the Israeli government. RCA was way ahead of its time. They saw the Agudas HaRabbanim, the people, Rav Leventhal, Rav Silda, Rav Rosenberg. No younger man ever got a chance there. So that's the way they worked. No one conquered RCA more than Louis Bernstein. He was elected president. He could never succeed himself. You follow, once his term ended, it ended. 3 different times he was president of RCA. As a matter of fact, he died in the presidency. When he died, he was president. Okay. Who was he? His years, 1927, 1995. Number one, he was born in the United States, had a total American education, graduate of Yeshiva College, 1947, and 3 years later was ordained by the Yeshiva, had his PhD from Bernard Revel, and what he wrote about, what he did for his PhD, is invaluable to us, as you will see. And as I mentioned, I think, weeks ago, we don't have any archives from the early years of the Rabbinical Council. Each time they moved, they misplaced material, lost material. Or you make a simple decision. Why are these archives important? You know, life moves on. The average person doesn't realize how important archives are when you want to reconstruct history, or as Rakefet says, when you want to guess what happened 50, 60, 70, 80 years ago. Louis Bernstein did his doctorate on the original years of the Rabbinical Council of America. He worked with documents. His book, which we'll quote time and again, Challenge and Mission, is a very important piece of work because whatever documents he saw and quotes, we no longer have access to. And this was an absolute major contribution. He began his career at the Glenwood Jewish Center in Brooklyn, and then in the early 50s became a chaplain in Korea. And it's very fascinating that both he and Rabbi Rachman served in the chaplaincy. Rabbi Hollander did not. It could very well be that serving in the chaplaincy opened them, made them more flexible. At a certain point in life, when you have to serve in the army and you have to deal with reform, conservative, non-Jews, and you know a chaplain has responsibility not just to Jews, ultimately, if there's no other chaplain and some Catholic or Protestant is dying and wants to see clergy, they will send the rabbi. This is part of the laws on which the American army functions, part of the protocol. And it could be that that accounts for why both rabbis, Rachman and Bernstein, were more open, more flexible than Rabbi Hollander. And finally, when we're going to talk about Rabbi Bernstein, pick up his life, his career, there was no more active rabbi than Rabbi Bernstein. But he was not involved in one man's Judaism. not involved in Avchat Kedushin. On that level, he was much more centrist than Rabbi Rachman. Perhaps you'll say he was not the great Talmud Chacham that Rabbi Rachman was. He was a Talmud Chacham, a Yodea Sefer, specialized in American Torah history, the RCA, his doctorate. But on that level, he certainly was in the camp of Rabbi Lamb, certainly a centrist, both feet solidly within what everyone agreed to. It was not Rabbi Rachman on that level. Within the, what would be the proper word, where there's agreement within the context, there may be a better word. The consensus, that's the word. He was certainly within the consensus. Where did he disagree with Rabbi Hollander? That was Board of Rabbis, Synagogue Council. On that level, Rabbi Bernstein was much more open. That which unites us is infinitely more important than that which divides us. And I can tell you, he and Rabbi Hollander would debate endlessly, quoting the Rav, and each one would swear that their position is exactly that of Moreinu v'Rabbeinu Rav Soloveitchik. It was amazing. You'd hear Rabbi Hollander, the Rav. You'd hear Rabbi Bernstein, the Rav. And you know what the truth is? The Rav was somewhere in the middle. He lent himself both to Rabbi Hollander and to Rabbi Bernstein. And we'll talk about it in great detail. The Rav was more nuanced. On one hand, we have little in common with Reform and conservative rabbis who totally compromise and alter halacha. On the other hand, when Rabbi Bernstein would quote the Rav, that which unites us is infinitely more important than that which divides us, he was correct. That was the Rav's point of view. And we'll come to it. Okay, we'll come back to Rabbi Bernstein, and we move back to RCA Be'ezrat Hashem next week. Material is very fascinating. It hurts me that not many people know what we're talking about. This has all been lost. I'm going to go into the whole microphone controversy. A lot can yet be written, and I have material that Rabbi Bernstein didn't have. You have to uncover, but we need young people willing to do serious doctorates. The problem today is everyone wants an easy doctorate, and nothing's easier than editing you edit a Rishon, deal with some responsible literature. To create Torah history, basically you have to have yesh mayayin. You have to create it and create it honestly and go through the sources. Not so simple, but it must be done. So to reiterate, what did we do today? We finished out Rabbi Rachman. I thank Nachum Shmayahu for what he sent me. I extend condolences to the Liebman family. These are friends of Nachum. They're students of mine, Aya and Chani. They lost their grandson to a crib death, three months old in Toronto. Son and daughter-in-law, Shluchim there. These are devoted, dedicated Chabadnikim. And never a crib death that we can't seem to overcome the crib deaths. It's something, a real tragedy, where a kid is fine and good, and the next morning you find he's not alive. Why do they say that the kid should sleep on his not on his stomach? They say, I don't know. Machlekes ha-paiskim. All right, and we've set the stage for next week. As I said an hour and a half ago, next week's shiur is normal. Monday, election day, there's no shiur. Sunday, yes. Monday, no. People wrote to me, they want to visit my shiur. I hope they're listening. That Monday, there will be no shiur. We have to vote. And I have to tell you about voting. 2 weeks. 2 weeks I'm talking about. Voting, you have to put on tallis and tefillin when you go to the election booth and not be cynical. People here are upset that it's the third election, the hell with the politicians. No. Torah, Yehuda v'Shomron, same-sex marriages, you have no idea what's at stake. You want a perfect world? Open up the Rambam, Perek Yedbet, Hilchot Malachim. When Mashiach comes, it'll be a lot better. But as far as I know, Mashiach is not here yet. I think both Rabbis Shera and Hollander will agree with me. So we got to accept the world with its problems, with its pimples, with its pus pimples. But boy, vote correctly.
Correctly,
you have a choice of three parties lachatchila. I'm voting for, what's it called, Tav. Yamina, I think it's called. I'm voting for Benich and Shaked and what's his name? The other one, Smachovitz, if I have it right. What's the name?
Smotrich.
Smotrich, right, correct. A funny name. You ought to Hebraize it, do the world a favor. Smotrich. I'm voting for them. Peretz, I don't have... You want to vote for Shas? Vote for Shas. They've proven themselves loyal people, and you have to forget... We have to look away from what Shas did to the Jewish people, killed a few thousand and so much heartache with supporting Oslo. You want to vote Agudat Yisrael? Look away from all the machlekes and the infighting and the enmity. Vote Agudat Yisrael. They've proven, Abriyut, they've proven to be loyal. If these three parties don't satisfy you, then b'dieved vote Likud. But I'm not happy about Likud because of Chilul Shabbos b'Parhesia. They will not fight for Shmirat Shabbos b'Parhesia. The mayor of Ramat Gan, Shem Rishon Yerkov, is a Likudnik. Ramat Gan has always been a Likud city. And they gave their chief rabbi, who was forced to retire at 80 years of age, Rabbi Yaakov Ariel, who's one of the great rabbanim of our times, they gave him a gift on his 80th birthday, buses on Shabbos. Shem Yerachim. You must fight for Shmirat Shabbos b'Parhesia. As far as the Trump plan, Trump is calling the shots, America's calling the shots. So on that level, it doesn't differ whether it's Gimel or whether it's Shas or whether it's the party I'm voting for. But okay, that's that. Now I want to show you something very beautiful. Here, I'm holding a sefer in front of me. Otsa HaSota. Sefer was published 80 years ago. This sefer, how do I come to it now? Because I'm learning, I'm going through Shas, as Rav Hashem, a third time, and I'm learning Sota now. I just reached Sota. And this is the first sefer written by an American-born youngster. This sefer is also one of the earliest doctorates given by what becomes Bernard Revel Graduate School. It's by Eliezer Tzvi Revel, the youngest son. Rabbi Revel had two sons. He was born in 1912, Norman was born in 1910. It's his youngest son, Eliezer Tzvi Revel. The volume is dedicated in memory of Dov Revel, and it's Hilchot Seiter of the Rambam. He dealt with 16 different manuscripts. Let me just quote it correctly. 16 different Kitva Yad and the original printings of the Mishneh Torah, and he gives you a edited edition of the text with a running commentary based upon Rishonim, some Achronim, and his Chavruter, from whom he has Haskama on the Sefer, is no less than Reb Chaim Zimmerman. They learned the Chavruter. It's a credit to the Revel family, to my family, we're blood relatives. And he writes, I guess that this is, he writes that he has checked it out. He was a librarian in YU. He has checked it out that this is the first sefer written by an American-born individual. So this is Revel. His life was sad. I don't want to go into more detail. His life was sad. Perhaps when we turn the microphone off, I'll give you more details. He never achieved his potential. Later in life, because his life was sad, Eli, are you listening with 2 ears? He turned to Hasidus. And a son of Rabbi Revel, a Litvak, raised in a Litvisha atmosphere, later in life, he wrote on Hasidus. He developed expertise there as well. He had a fabulous head, as you can see. And I used to say for whenever I have many Rambams and many edited Rambams in my house, I have to have 3 different edited Rambams, but I use this because I want to bring some, I want to do something for his memory. Charlie?
Steinzel's put out also a Rambam.
I'm not aware of it. I'd like to see it. Steinsaltz or Frankel? Who are you talking about?
Steinsaltz.
He's put out a Rambam.
In his commentaries, he brings up the date he showed him that moment.
Very nice. And it's an edited text. You've got to remember. Very nice. I have to look at it. Where do you see it? Who knows?
Urim?
Corin. Very nice. This is for Charlie. This is to answer your question. This is an overview of the Shalom Zacha by the Kloisenberger Rebbe, and in it they have a source, if you have a daughter, to do something, Zevach Habat, I think it's called, to do something Friday night as well. This is interesting, of course. A kid asked the Lubavitcher Rebbe why you don't move to Israel. This is like that lady, Rebbetzin, what was the last name, from Kedumim, he's the Rebbe of Kedumim. Miriam, his wife Miriam Zichrona Levracha Tzadeket, asked the Rav after the 67 war why he doesn't move to Israel. That's the famous letter where the Rav answers her. And so here you see the Rebbe's answer to the kid. This is again about Pope Francis. The Catholic new liberal clergy is shocked. The new Pope refuses to allow married priests in remote areas. Here's very interesting, the New York Times as usual, how a trillion trees triumphed over Trump's climate denialism. And it makes the point that Trump introduced something, had to plant a million trees, and people stopped criticizing him that he's against clearing up the atmosphere. And here's something too. You're not listening, here's why. It's about, having had this with your wife, she says something to you and you can't even repeat it, you're not listening, you say to her, you're not listening. It explains why people who are very close to each other and how we simply don't listen, it doesn't register with us. Stanley Cohn, Nobelist, dies at 97, may break through studies on cell growth, and this guy won the Nobel Prize, and again the New York Times obituary, but I always ask the question, was is geblieben mit Yiddishkeit? 3 children from his first marriage, Carrie Cohn, Bert Bishop, and Ken Larson. Bishop Larson, was is geblieben from sein Yiddishkeit? And here's a sad article that when we read, there were breakthroughs with Alzheimer's. We don't have anything now. It did not prove successful. So there's nothing that we have now to help people who have Alzheimer's. Harvard and Yale ensnared an education department crackdown on foreign funding. Charlie, a Harvard graduate, you have to be ashamed. They're being supported by Arabs and who knows what, influencing their policies, and they avoided telling it to the government. Let's see what happens. Harvard and Yale ain't Kleinigkeit to take them on. And here's New York City, what we all know with de Blasio, crime more than ever. Yitzchak, in front of you are the Rackman articles, one of them, Liebman's article, they're 2 copies. So give the other one away and the other 2 you can take. My dear students, I want to thank you very much for participating until we meet again in health and happiness. Das Vedanya. What did I promise to tell you?